Welcome to Everyday Martial Artist, a weekly podcast where you'll join me, Brian Doucette, as I interview a different martial artist each episode and hear their story. Some guests you may have heard of, and some you probably haven't. Be sure to subscribe where all your favorite podcasts are available. Also, visit our website at everydaymartialartist.com. If you're listening for a specific interview, I sure hope you'll stay and check out the other episodes. A very special thank you to Topher Williams for our custom theme music. And now, the newest episode of Everyday Martial Artist. Everyday Martial Artist is brought to you by KOOnline.com for all your martial arts needs. Sparring and safety gear, rank belts, uniforms, weapons, patches, and more. Wholesale supplies made by martial artists for martial artists. Visit us today at KO-Online.com. Hello and welcome to Everyday Martial Artist. I'm your host, Brian Doucette. And as we do every week, we're joined by a brand new guest talking about their life and their journey throughout the world of martial arts and other stuff they're involved in. My guest today is a Tokyo-based lawyer, author, and martial artist who was born and raised in Northern California. A longtime student of the Japanese language, he first traveled to Japan on a year-long study abroad program in college. His book, Ways to Die in Tokyo, is the first in a planned trilogy about an expat MMA fighter. He currently holds black belts in both judo and BJJ. He's married to two children, and in his spare time enjoys spending time with his family, reading, writing, and exploring Tokyo's amazing food scene. Please welcome my guest today, Mr. Thomas Rand Garver. How are you doing today, sir?
Good. Thanks, Brian. How are you?
I'm doing good. I appreciate your time. I know with you being in Tokyo, it's a little tricky to try to schedule these things. And you told me it's 8 a.m. in the morning there, and it's, you know, 6 p.m. for me. So I could never do an 8 a.m. one. With decades in radio and professional voiceover, I know what time of day I have to be around for my voice to actually sound good. Earliest I can do is 10 a.m. I've had a few clients, like in Europe, like, oh, can you record this voiceover live with us at this time? And it's like 4 a.m. I'm like, oh, if you want me to sound like Jack Nicholson, I can.
I'm sufficiently caffeinated, so I think I'm good to go.
Well, there we go. And I don't drink caffeine. I gave up caffeine almost 25, yeah, February 99. So like 25 years ago, I gave up caffeine.
Oh my gosh. I didn't really get hooked on it until I was in my 40s.
Oh, really? My early
40s. Okay. Yeah, I never drank coffee or tea. And they have in Japan they have drink vending machines all over the place, and
okay,
canned coffee is very popular, and really? Some of it is really good, and a friend of mine got me hooked on the canned coffee here.
Interesting. And, okay, I know you've listened to some episodes of the show, so you know how we like to kick it off. I want to go back to the very beginning and kind of find out where that first interest, that first spark came from that kind of turned you on to martial arts.
Sure. So I was 5 years old and was watching the old Kung Fu TV series with David Carradine.
Nice.
And decided at the age of five that I wanted to be Kwai Chan Kane.
Nice.
I was born in Eureka, California, which is about a 6 to 7 hour drive north of San Francisco. And my parents split. So I was five when I first saw the old Kung Fu TV series. My parents split when I was six, and my brothers and I moved with my mom down to the Bay Area in California.
Okay.
And from the time I was five, I had this burning desire to learn a martial art. And I started collecting magazines and books. Every time a birthday or a holiday or any kind of special occasion rolled around, I would beg my mom to buy me a martial arts book. And so I had all of the, I don't know if you remember Bruce Tegner.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. Yeah. So the Bruce Tegner books, you know, the complete book of karate, the complete book of judo, the complete book of kung fu, et cetera, et cetera. And I would just for hours, you know, pore over these books. And we were kind of, until my mom remarried when I was eight, we kind of moved around a lot. And I didn't really have a chance. We didn't have really a chance to settle down so that I could maybe join a karate school somewhere. So okay. I would spend hours poring over these books and magazines. You know, looking through these old Bruce Tegner books they fascinated me, but you couldn't really learn much from them.
Right.
It was, you know, they had a series of photographs. There would be, you know, sequences, you know, how to throw a punch, how to defend a punch, how to do this, how to do that. But the photos weren't really, you couldn't really tell from the photos what you were supposed to do. And, you know, the explanations were kind of sparse. And I was, you know, I was 6 or 7 years old, so I didn't know. So,
right.
So anyway, so this is how I kind of kept up my interest in the martial arts until I was 8 or 9, and my mom had remarried, and we were living in a town called Fairfield in California, close to Travis Air Force Base. And there were actually three karate schools in the area.
Wow.
And yeah, so for my, I think it was my eighth or my ninth birthday, I asked for karate lessons. And so we went, and my mom and stepdad took me to this karate school. It was Al Reyes Kenpo Karate.
Okay.
In Cicero, California, which is a town right next door to Fairfield. And I joined that day. And yeah, Al Reyes was one of the pioneers of Kaju Kenbo, mm-hmm. which I've heard of.
Yep.
And so Fairfield was kind of a big Kaju Kenbo town. Maybe that had something to do with the fact that Travis Air Force Base was right there. You had, so Al Reyes' school, there was another guy, Tony Ramos, and then another guy, Calvin Shin. They all taught Kaju Kenbo, but they all had different kind of, from what I understood at the time, they had like a different take on the martial art. So anyways, I started there, and for 5 years,
okay.
Did that from you know, I think it must have been when I was nine, I guess. I did Kaju Kenbo there at Al Reyes' school. He passed away when I was 10, and his son, Alan, took over. But I was there until we moved. We moved from Fairfield when I was 14 in middle school. And it was heartbreaking for me because this was my thing. I was a runty kid. I was always, up until I was a senior in high school, I weighed about a buck. Well, when I graduated from high school, I weighed about a buck 10.
Wow.
I was always pretty small, and karate gave me confidence, you know, warranted or not. I mean, that's debatable, but I was just in love with karate. And so when we moved, it just crushed me. And we moved up into kind of a rural area of California, east of Stockton. And there were no karate schools in the area.
Okay.
And so I just kind of had to give it up for a while.
Think back to maybe those first four or five classes at that school. What are some things you remember about, you know, what are some of the, maybe the things you learned and, you know, some of the things you remember about those first few classes?
Oh, geez. Well, that's a good question. From the very first class, it was very clear to me that there were kids, some kids in the class who were just really, you just knew they were really tough kids.
Okay.
And then there were the kid, you know, there were kids like me who weren't so tough, but we all kind of gave me a sense of esprit de corps because we all kind of stuck together. And I did get my butt kicked a lot in practice, but it gave me a sense of belonging that I hadn't had before. And it was a really close-knit club. One of the guys that I practiced with, we're friends to this day, is, you may have heard the name Dan Stell.
Sounds familiar. Yeah.
Bam Bam Stell. Yeah. He's done a lot of refereeing over the years, but okay. he was a kickboxing champion. And so anyways, yeah, going back to your question, what did I learn? I learned that I could, you know, if I worked at it, I could get better.
Okay.
And I learned about perseverance. You know, if I just stuck with it, I could get better and I could get tougher.
Okay.
I wasn't necessarily going to be the toughest kid in the class, but you know, if you get thumped on enough, you kind of learn to take a little punishment and it makes you more confident.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's kind of, that was a long time ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know. I've asked myself the same question about when I started when I was 10 and I literally only remember like one thing from the first month I was in it. That's it. I remember one thing we did. And that, so I still ask the question because some people have really good memories and really vivid memories and stuff. And I figure maybe I'll get some good answers, and other people like, God, that was a long time ago. I don't remember. So it's worth asking because you never know.
Oh, absolutely. And if we're talking about like techniques, I very quickly realized that I was pretty flexible at the time.
Oh, nice.
And so my people, and it didn't take long before people were like complimenting my kicks because mm-hmm. I kick really high. That's so flexible. Like I said, I competed in local tournaments.
Oh, cool.
And it was fun, but it was also scary. Mm-hmm. I ended up doing a lot of kata competition because I quickly discovered that as a smaller kid, I mean, this is a point karate.
Mm-hmm.
I would go in and just get blasted. But it didn't make me want to quit, but it was a little discouraging. So I kind of leaned toward kata and did really well in that.
Okay.
Not really well, but you know, I was pretty decent.
Yeah.
In one of the competitions. So yeah, once we moved to this more rural part of California, I didn't really do much karate until I was in high school.
Oh, wow.
when a local cop started teaching Taekwondo.
Cool.
At the high school there.
Okay.
And I did that for a year or two, and that was fun. But really, I my heart was still with Kajukenbo, and Taekwondo was, it just didn't seep into me like.
That's surprising with you. You talk about your flexibility and your good kicks. That's kind of surprising you didn't go to that more.
Yeah. I don't know what it was. Maybe it was just being, I think, you know, I was already was a junior, senior high school. And I, you know, of course discovered girls and was, you know, focusing on my studies too, trying to. And
do you remember which style or which system of Taekwondo it was?
Song Mukwan.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. I did that 2 years ago. Nice.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So Song Mukwan. So I, when we left Fairfield, I was a brown belt in Kajukenbo. And I quickly, I think within a year, I had my brown belt in Song Mukwan. And it was cool because I started seeing a lot of parallels with some of the things that we did in Kajukenbo. The forms, some of the techniques and the forms were similar. Like I said, it didn't really kind of ignite anything in me. And so I wrestled for a couple of years in high school.
Nice.
That was fun. I wasn't particularly good at that either. And I didn't really dive back into martial arts until I was in my 20s and here in Japan.
I was going to ask what led you back to it, but I suppose being in Japan, it's a little easier to get involved in martial arts probably than...
Yeah. So in the meantime, I majored in Japanese language in college and I came here as an exchange student during college. But it wasn't until I had graduated from college and came back on a fellowship and was here for, so the exchange program was a year long. I went back, graduated from college, and then I came back here on a fellowship, and that was 2 years, but I ended up staying for six. I got married, and this was in the late 80s, early 90s. Okay. And my fellowship had wrapped up and I just landed a job and had been working this job for a couple of years. And my brother called and said, "Hey, you got to see, there's this thing called the Ultimate Fighting Championship." So anybody who started jiu-jitsu, Brazilian jiu-jitsu back in the early 90s in the US has kind of a similar story, right?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So here I am in Japan and my brother says, you know, you got to watch this thing. There's this little Brazilian guy and he's, you know, they have fights between the different martial arts and this little Brazilian guy's killing everybody. He's choking everybody and that's how he's winning. I'm like, what are you talking about? He goes, no, I'm serious. You got to check it out. Like, see if you can get a hold of a tape. And so hung up. And that day I went to a little video store in our neighborhood and I asked the guy at the counter if he had this, you know, the Ultimate Fighting Championship. And he goes, "Oh yeah, we have that." And so I grabbed that. And then he gave me a couple of more tapes. Pancras.
Ah, you heard nice. Of Pancras? Oh yeah.
Yeah. So Pancras and what was the other one? I can't remember. Okay. Oh, Shoot Fighting.
Ah, right. Okay. Pancras.
So I got a bunch of these videos and I took them home and I watched them. And I thought, oh my God, I got to do this jiu-jitsu. I got to do jiu-jitsu. At the time, this was in 93 or 94.
That would have probably 94 because UFC 1 was December 93.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yep. So there were no Brazilian jiu-jitsu places here in Japan at the time, but there was judo and there was a tiny little judo dojo in my neighborhood. And my buddy who had watched this UFC tape with me said, "Hey, why don't we go and join this judo club?" And so we went over there and I started practicing there. And then I started, somebody at work had told me about the Kodokan, the National Judo Center here. Mm-hmm. And I started practicing there. So yeah, long story short, I did judo for about a year.
Okay.
And I was, it was 28 or 29 at the time. So I had this, you know, this big gap in my martial arts career.
Right.
And at the same time, my wife and I were getting ready to move back to the US because I decided to go to grad school and she was going to go back to school too.
Okay.
So we moved back to California, moved to LA in 1995. And the first thing I did when we landed was go through the Yellow Pages and find Hicks and Gracie's Jiu-Jitsu Academy.
Nice.
So I ended up going there and joining, and it was this, so there was, it was on, I don't know if you're familiar with Los Angeles.
Oh yeah. I worked and lived in the area for a year in the 96, 97.
Oh, okay. So yeah, Pico, right on Pico going towards, what was the mall? the Westwood Mall.
Okay.
The right hand side, there was this an auto body shop, and the dojo was a karate dojo and they rented space out to Hickson in the morning, and I guess in the afternoon. So they rented space to Hickson for his Brazilian jiu-jitsu lessons. And so the only way you would have known that there was a jiu-jitsu school there was this. There was a sign with spray painted white plywood with black stenciled letters, Hickson Gracie Jiu-Jitsu Academy.
Wow.
Yeah. So, but then, you know, I go there and immediately it was just, the vibe there was just incredible. And then you had such a great mix of people. You had, it was kind of a weird combination of thug types and professional types.
Okay.
With kind of artsy types mixed in. So, you know, we had, have you heard the name Henry Akins?
Yes.
So Henry was a blue belt at the time. Henry was there. Maynard from the band Tool. Do you know the band Tool?
I know I'm not a fan, but I know who they are. Yeah.
Yeah. So Maynard and the rest of the band, they were training there. The actor Frank Grillo, he was there for about 6 months.
Okay.
Yeah. I was there. He was a very intense guy. I remember I was going to, it was the 7 or 7:30 a.m. classes, and I would get there and we'd be doing the warm up, and Frank would be leading the warm up. And I remember going in one morning and we were running around and doing our warm up exercise. He said, "Come on, you pussies." And I'm like, oh, geez, wow. I haven't even woken up yet, you know?
Jeez.
So,
that's awesome.
Yeah, so I was there for a year. This is in 1995.
Okay.
So I was there in 1996. I got my blue belt from Hickson. And then my wife and I moved up to Northern California because I was set to start law school up there.
Okay.
I had already asked around at Hickson School, you know, we're moving. Where do I train? And so they all said, you got to train with his cousin, Half. So I ended up training at Half Gracie's in Mountain View, California for the next 9 years.
Oh wow.
Yeah. 8 years.
I want to back up just a little bit. When you were in Japan and looking for did you come across any Japanese jiu-jitsu schools, and was that ever considered, or you found the judo one and that's what you settled on?
I just found the judo one and that's what I settled on. And I knew at the time that there was a difference between Brazilian jiu-jitsu and Japanese jiu-jitsu.
Right.
So I think that even if I had known of any Japanese jiu-jitsu schools, I probably wouldn't have been inclined to go and check them out.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
The other question I have is, you mentioned this thing my listeners probably never heard of. What's a video store?
Yeah.
I've probably had a couple of guests that might not know what it is. So I've interviewed a 14-year-old and a 16-year-old, so they've probably never seen a video store before.
Yeah, I guess I'm dating myself there. But for your younger listeners, a video store, once upon a time, there were these things called video stores, and people would go to them and rent videotapes.
Actual cassette and VHS cassette tapes, man.
Yeah, yeah.
And
you couldn't
days.
Watch them too many times because they would wear out.
That's right. They don't know how cool it was to be in a Blockbuster on a Friday night. I mean, come on. Those were the days.
Yeah. What's fascinating now, just to kind of jump ahead with jiu-jitsu and every other martial art nowadays, mm-hmm. there's just so much knowledge, resources available online.
Yes.
It's just mind-blowing. And back then, with something like jiu-jitsu, Brazilian jiu-jitsu, there was nothing. We passed around at Hickson's. We passed around bootleg VHS tapes. There were a few instructionals at the time. This is in 95.
Yep.
And one I remember very clearly was Pedro Carvalho's Advanced Black Belt Techniques.
Nice.
We all studied this tape, and it was great. But it was not. If you compared that to the kinds of instructionals that people have available to them nowadays. I mean, there's just a world of difference. They were, you know, techniques in isolation, basically.
Yeah.
And you couldn't really, I mean, in jiu-jitsu it's about transitions and you know, how to get from this position to this position to this position to the submission, or, you know, you can watch somebody execute an armbar and learn from it, but now you know how to do an armbar, but you don't really know how to get there.
Right.
Yeah. So there wasn't a lot of these bootleg VHS tapes are really kind of the only thing, the only game in town in terms of learning outside the class.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure we wore out my Marco Huas King of the Streets instructional videos that I ordered. And me and a few other students back in the mid-90s, we watched those things till they were probably couldn't be watched anymore. So yeah, exactly. I know where you're coming from.
Yeah. So yeah, so we moved up to Northern California. I was a blue belt and I started at Ralph Gracie's Academy and I was one of the only blue belts there at the time.
Wow.
It was kind of a big deal. I mean, in the U.S. to have a blue belt in BJJ,
especially you know, under Hickson too.
Yeah. Although. And it was kind of a big deal. There just weren't that many people doing BJJ, and even fewer who'd done it for long enough to get a blue belt or any other belt. So, but there were, you know, obviously, because this was already we were already into what in the BJJ community in the U.S. they call the second wave. So I guess I was kind of in the second wave.
Okay.
And the first wave was a handful of Americans who got their black belts in the late 80s or early 90s. I think Chuck Norris was one of those people.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, he did a lot with someone with the Gracies, and also he's really, really in with the Machado brothers too. So.
Right. Anyway, so yeah, I started training at Ralph Gracie's and got to train and rub shoulders with the likes of, well, there's just a bunch of guys. A lot of them have their own schools now, but Dave Camarillo, his brother Dan, Alan Gumby Marquez, Mike Prudencio, who else? BJ Penn was there he came in 97 or 98. And so, yeah, I was there. I ended up training there until the end of 2003 and got my purple belt from Half before we moved back here to Japan. I had a job offer here in Japan and we moved. My wife was 7 months pregnant. We sold everything we had and kind of landed here in Tokyo with pretty much nothing but the clothes on our backs.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and once again, you know, one of the first things I did when we landed was figure out where I was going to train. Mm-hmm. So, and my wife was very, very tolerant. By now, she knew that jiu-jitsu was an important part of my life and it was something that I really needed just for stress and just to keep a healthy state of mind. Mm-hmm. And, so anyways, I ended up training at a school called Axis.
Okay.
Axis Jiu-Jitsu here in Tokyo. I was there for about 13 years. And the guy who runs Axis is a black belt under Hickson. So
nice.
Yeah.
I'm assuming by that point when you moved back, there was a lot more options for Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu than the first time you were there.
Yes. Well, it's still 2004. So there weren't too many, but there were
not a ton, but at least you found some.
Right. So yeah, I started training at Axis and I was there for 13 years, got my brown belt from Axis. And then it was a really kind of a gnarly commute from where I lived out to the school. And it just got harder and harder. My kids were getting older and family life was becoming a little more demanding. Mm-hmm. So I started training at another school. And anyway, long story short, Carpe Diem is where I moved to and I'm currently training.
Okay.
And got my black belt from Half. So it was kind of coming full circle.
Nice.
In that respect. Yeah. Yeah. So
did you ever get back into judo or?
Oh yeah, sorry. Okay. I kind of skipped over that, didn't I? I kind of cross trained judo and jiu-jitsu.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, from the time we landed in LA. So I trained. I was training jiu-jitsu and judo at the same time. I was training judo in LA at Southtail Judo Club.
Okay,
which is one of the bigger judo clubs in California, and got my brown belt there. And then after a year, we moved up north, mm-hmm. and. Once we moved, I started training judo at a place called Santa Clara Pal Judo Club.
Okay.
And I ended up competing locally in judo in Northern California quite a bit.
Oh, really? Nice.
For local tournaments. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I had a lot of fun with that and got my judo black belt from my instructors at Santa Clara Pal. It was Keith Watanabe, Ed Higashi, and Bryce Soriano.
Okay.
And once we moved here... once we moved back to Japan, I was almost 40 and realizing that judo is just so high impact and rough.
Yeah.
That I just, you know, I thought, well, you know, I think it's time to start doing BJJ exclusively. Okay. It's just much easier on the body.
Yeah.
So I stopped training judo.
Okay.
And focused exclusively on BJJ. Okay. And ended up.
Did you compete a lot in BJJ too?
Yeah, I did. I competed a lot here. Well, I mean, I guess it depends on how you define a lot. There are people training nowadays, you know, the younger folks who are competing like every week. It's just insane.
Yeah.
Yeah. But for about 10 years, I competed a lot locally here in Japan. And then I competed in the World Masters BJJ Championships.
Okay.
A couple of times. And the last time was in 2016. I got silver at brown belt.
Okay. Very
and cool. Yeah, a lot of fun. And then the last time I competed was in 2018. It was here at the in Tokyo for the Asian Championships, and got silver there.
Nice.
So and that was at the black belt division. So.
Okay, cool. And have you ever got your kids involved in martial arts?
Good question. So yes, I had them doing judo when they. So my kids are 20, almost 20, and almost 18.
Okay,
my boys. And when they were 9 and 7 or 8 and 6, I started them in judo. And they did that for about 2 years, and they seemed to really like it. Mm-hmm. And then my older son broke his arm pretty badly in judo. It's kind of a freak accident, and had to have 2 surgeries.
Dang.
And it was just this really traumatic thing for the kids. And after that, both of them were kind of like, you know, no, we're not going to, we don't want to do this anymore.
Okay, makes sense. I get it.
I didn't want to force them.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
They're both really athletic. So they, my older son plays college squash. And my younger son, he runs and swims.
Okay, cool.
So, yeah.
And what about your wife? Did she ever pick up your interest in martial arts? Or
No. You know, she didn't. Okay. She didn't. She, no.
That's too bad.
Not her thing.
Definitely weren't going to force her, so.
Yeah.
Probably wouldn't turn out well.
Probably not.
So, what any of the, you know, going back to karate, you know, taekwondo, judo, did you ever get involved in the teaching side of martial arts? Was that something that ever interested you?
You know, one time it did, but there was really never any opportunity to start teaching. And Sam, the short answer is no. I was interested in teaching for a while. And then I got super busy doing other things, and it just, yeah, now,
makes sense.
Especially with the writing, it's pretty time consuming. As I mean, it's a hobby, but it's a very time consuming hobby. So,
yeah. And I'm glad you mentioned that. So first of all, what led to the interest in writing? And then I definitely want you to talk about the first book and then the planned trilogy, like I mentioned.
Sure. So, well, I've always been an avid reader ever since I was a kid, my martial arts magazines and books. Mm-hmm. And I love reading fiction, both fiction and nonfiction. And I wrote some stories when I was a kid, and that was fun. And I was always kind of in the idea of writing something, writing a book of some kind was always kind of in the back of my head. And I never really started to think seriously about doing it until it was actually not until I met one of your previous guests, Barry Eisler, mm-hmm. who I met at Half Gracie Jiu-Jitsu, Mountain View, California. And at the time, Barry had just, his first book was just about to be released.
Okay.
And so I, you know, snapped up the book as soon as it came out. And I just thought it was the coolest thing. And I thought, man, you know, it'd be really cool to write something. And at the time I thought, well, what do I know? What, you know, what could I write? And I had no idea. And so I just kind of let it go and didn't really think about writing again until I think it was probably around 2011 or 2012.
Okay.
I was on Metacritic and I was searching for recommendations for thrillers because I'm a huge thriller fan.
Okay.
And I came across a thread and the question was, does anybody know of a good thriller with an MMA fighter as the main character? And nobody knew any books that fit the profile.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, huh. So I kind of rolled that around in my brain for a little while. And I thought, okay, I think I want to write a thriller about a fighter. I had no idea how to do it. I kind of knew from reading so many thrillers, what was good and what wasn't, but I had no idea how to actually put a book together, let alone one that people would want to read
right.
and have fun with. So I started writing and without really any clear idea of a main character or what I wanted to, well, what kind of story I wanted to write. I just started writing and most of it was crap. And then I picked up a book. This was in 2000. The book came out in 2014. It's, I think it's not very well known, and which is really sad because it's just an amazing book. It's called Beast Blood. What is it? Was it Blood? I may get the title wrong. So forgive me if this is wrong, but Blood Struggle and Heart, Blood Struggle and Something at the Heart of Mixed Martial Arts.
Okay.
And written by a sports writer named Doug Merlino. And what it was it was a collection of profiles, four or five MMA fighters who were active at the time. And one of them was this guy named Jeff Munson. I don't know if you've ever heard of.
Yep, I've heard of Jeff.
Yeah. So Jeff, so if you know Jeff, if you know of Jeff, I mean, he started competing in jiu-jitsu and MMA back in like 97.
Yep.
And he won the Abu Dhabi Combat Championships twice, and just an amazing grappler and huge guy. He's like 5'9", weight 240 or 250, just this beast of a guy. But one of the profiles that Merlino does in this book is about Jeff Munson. And he, you know, when the book came out, Munson was still fighting, and this was 2014. You know, he started fighting in 97. So he was, by the time Merlino interviewed him, he was physically just a wreck. He'd suffered a string of really bad injuries, and I guess his wife was begging him to stop, and his kid or kids wanted him to stop, and he just couldn't do it. He couldn't stop fighting. And it's just this really kind of sad, perplexing story. And it even got, you know, got even weirder later on when, I don't know if you know his story, but he ended up renouncing his U.S. citizenship and becoming a Russian citizen, and has been in Russia ever since, and fought well into his 50s. So, yeah, so I read this and I thought, you know, what if, you know, there was a like a Jeff Munson type character in Tokyo trying to make a, you know, trying to make a living as an MMA fighter, trying to, you know, like chasing the dream, right? And that's when the, kind of the story in broad strokes kind of came together for me. Okay. So I spent about 4 years writing just without really knowing exactly what I was doing. And once I had that kernel of an idea, then I started to figure out the story I wanted to tell. And I started reading about, you know, the craft of writing fiction, mm-hmm. story structure. I read a ton of books about writing. And so about 4 years in, everything started to come together. I started to figure out how to do it, started to know what I was doing. And then it took me another 4 years to actually get to where I had, okay, now I have a book. So I have this book, mm-hmm. and it's about an MMA fighter. He's a washed up, more or less washed up MMA fighter. He's in Tokyo he's still chasing the dream. And the MMA boom in Japan has already come and gone. And he's had a bunch of injuries, and his wife, who's begged him to stop, has taken their two kids and left him. And he's just kind of alone, and things are not good. And so he really wants to get his family back, and he starts down a path towards doing that, and things kind of go from bad to worse.
Okay, interesting.
He gets involved with an organized crime group, kind of inadvertently. A friend turns him on to a part-time job that ends up being much, much more than that, and much more than he bargained for. So that's kind of the start of his downward spiral.
Nice.
A lot of action. Yeah. A lot of martial arts. So
I've read the reviews, and it sounds like it's been really.
Yeah, it's got a pretty good reception. And I hope it's a fun read.
Mm-hmm.
If you like martial arts, I would hope be right up your alley. So.
Yeah, I definitely added it to my list. I'm just, you know, if you've heard a few awesome. Of my shows, you probably heard me say I don't have time to read anymore. I need to. I used to read a book a week until I started this podcast, and now I've probably read three books in the last year. So
yeah, that's the book. And people are busy, and y'all were being pulled in so many different directions. It's sitting down with a book and actually focusing on, you know, on one thing without getting distracted and wanting or having to do something else. It's tough.
Yeah.
So, and it's a big, you know, reading a book is a big time commitment.
Yep.
I tried to structure it so that, you know, the chapters are fairly short.
Okay.
They're kind of bite sized. So you can dive in and, you know, you can read a chapter or two, set it down, come back to it. That kind
nice.
Of so,
okay.
Yeah.
I'm definitely going to order a copy, and hopefully at some point in the next year or two, I'll be able to find time to read it. But I definitely, and what's funny, I'm trying, one of those things I told you, I need to take notes on who said this. Someone I interviewed in the last 2 weeks recommended your book to me. That's how I found you while trying to do an interview with you.
That's so cool to hear. Yeah. And I think I know who it is. Can I say his name?
Yeah, if you think, you know, yeah.
Yeah, I think it must have been Dave Kroll, because you mentioned that.
Yeah,
you
definitely. Him. Yeah, I bet it was Dave Kroll. Yeah, yeah. I know it was either him or one of three people that I remember interviewing like around that time. So yeah, definitely.
It would be awesome if it was all three, but
you never know. I do have a lot of guests mention the same books, and a lot of them are sometimes you know, not ones I've heard of. So that's kind of cool when more than one person mentions a book I've never heard of before, then I definitely add it to my list. So that's good. That's very great.
Well, yeah.
So when are you hoping to have, and you said you spent like 4 years working on it. When are you hoping to have the second one out?
I'm hoping I'll have a first draft by the end of this year, early next year.
Oh, wow. And okay.
Once I have that, it'll be probably another 3 months before I have an edited version that's ready for publication. So okay. I'm looking at probably the middle of next year.
Nice.
And I would love to be able to write faster, but I want, you know, I have, you know, I work.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know you do too.
Those dang jobs.
Yeah, I have a limited time. So I try to set aside a little bit of time every day, either early in the morning or late at night to do this. And that's usually enough. If I can do it every day, it's enough time. If you think about it, I mean, a typical novel is about 90 to 95,000 words, which is that's roughly 300 pages.
Okay.
If you write, you know, even 250 to 500 words a day, every day for a year.
Yeah.
You're pretty close, right?
I had one guest, I'm trying to remember who said this, but he was saying about another author I talked to, and he was saying 20 minutes a day. He said, 20 minutes a day, you could write a book in about a year and a half. And like, if you actually focus for 20 minutes, sometimes you'll get into it, you'll spend more time. But if you set aside 20 minutes a day to do it, you can do it. And I'm like, interesting. That's one thing I've thought about, kind of like you. I've thought about it. I used to love writing when I was younger. Well, for me, it's obviously the time. I wouldn't even have 20 minutes a day to put into it right now, but I'll leave it to other people for now.
Yeah. No, but it's absolutely true. I think if you think about the way, you know, the things you do throughout the day, or I guess for you, you know, similar to me, it would be like, what do you do in what little spare time you have?
Yeah.
You got 20 minutes that, you know, that you would otherwise have spent watching Netflix or, you know, scrolling through YouTube for stuff to watch. Even 20 minutes, if you can pump out, you know, 250 words, and that's not much.
No.
You know, it's not even a page. It's maybe a double spaced page.
Okay.
At the end of a year, you're going to have a novel. Now, it's not going to be a good novel, right? And you're going to have to rewrite and rewrite and rewrite, because writing is really rewriting.
Yeah.
But you will have enough material to work with. So yeah, it's just a matter of, and that's, it's interesting because of the perseverance that I think you need to be able to do it is something that we, you know, I mean, if you're going to do it, you'll find that the same perseverance that served you so well in martial arts mm-hmm. your whole life will serve you well in writing or any other endeavor too, right? And
if I were to spend the time writing that I spend on my podcast every day, I could probably write 3 novels a year pretty easily.
Well, keep doing your podcast. I like your podcast, so I don't want you to, you know.
Yeah, me too. I enjoy doing it, and it's probably easier than writing. I love audio. I love editing audio. I love talking martial arts. So it's definitely fun. So, in all your years of martial arts, is there one philosophy you learned that is at the top of your list?
Yeah, that's actually a pretty easy one for me, and that's don't quit.
Nice.
It's something you hear a lot in BJJ too, you know, because mm-hmm. BJJ is really. I mean, all martial arts, to get good at any of them, you have to work really hard at them.
Yep.
With BJJ, I found it, I think most people find it particularly hard because it's, you know, when you spar, you're sparring with somebody and you're doing it with full resistance, right? And it just takes a really long time to get good at it. And the only way you can get good at it is to just keep doing it.
Right.
Just keep doing it. And then, it's a great approach to anything you want to get good at. I think it's maybe the only approach is don't, you know, work at it and don't quit. If you quit, I mean, it goes without saying, you're not going to get good at it.
Right? That is true. Yeah. My core system is traditional Taekwondo. I've been doing that longer than any of the other styles I've been in. And one of our tenets, we have 5 tenets of Taekwondo, and one of them is perseverance. So that's, you know, big sign on the wall. We have courtesy, integrity, perseverance, self-control, and indomitable spirit. And, you know, perseverance. Perseverance is one of the big ones. Yeah, I mean, they're all important, obviously, but perseverance is the one we probably hear about the most. Makes sense. It's a good one. It's a good pick.
And they all kind of go hand in hand, you know, the indomitable spirit. Yeah. I mean, you don't quit. I mean, I tell my kids that, you know, don't quit. And kind of, you know, serve you well throughout life, really anything that you set your mind to, and
exactly.
You really want to be good at. You just do it. You may not end up being the best in the world. In fact, chances are you won't be the best in the world, but you will get better.
Yeah.
And there's so much satisfaction to be derived from really applying yourself to something over a long period of time and getting better at it. It's incredibly gratifying.
Like you said, that's definitely something anyone, I mean, most of my listeners who are probably involved in martial arts, that's any martial artist can relate to that.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
All right. We got some fun questions to wrap up the interview. So three, four, five names you would put on your personal Mount Rushmore of martial arts.
Oh, wow. That's a great question. My personal Mount Rushmore.
Yep.
Rushmore.
Yep. I've had people put like only their instructors. I've had people list names I've never heard of. I've had people put only big names like Bruce Lee and Chuck Norris. So yeah, it's completely up to you.
Okay. Al Reyes would be the first face up there.
Okay.
And his son, can they count for one?
Like I said, I've had people list as few as two names and as many as eight. So, you know,
okay.
Have at it.
So Alan Reyes
okay.
would count for one in my book. And then Hicks and Gracie and Half Gracie.
Nice.
Half Gracie in particular. That's already four. I have to say Dave Camarillo.
Nice.
And then I would have to say someone that none of your listeners will have heard of because he's a personal friend and he's not well-known martial arts, but he's been a training partner and friend of mine for about 20 years. And his name is Taki Ishikawa.
Okay.
And a great guy, former Jeet Kune Do guy. He was actually Jeet Kune Do instructor who trained under, I can't remember his name. Somebody, one of the guys who had trained directly under Bruce Lee.
Okay. Like Dan Inosanto or one of those guys.
Not Inosanto. It was Batista. Was it? No, not Batista. I can't remember. But yeah, training partner for almost 20 years.
Nice.
And good friend. And just a great martial artist and guy. And then I would also put up Keith Vargo.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, who we talked about briefly before you started recording. So, you know, Keith is, he also lives here in Japan. And he wrote a column for Black Belt Magazine for about 20 years and has a couple of books. Can I mention the names of the
book? Definitely. Absolutely.
So one is called The Philosophy of Fighting and the other is The Soul of Fighting, and they're collections of his writings. And I encourage anyone, all of your listeners, since they're all martial artists, to pick up these books. I have never read anyone write as fluidly and deeply about martial arts as Keith. And not only that, he's a phenomenal martial artist. He can do everything. He can box. He can grapple. He's had pro and amateur fights, and just an all around great martial artist and guy.
Okay, yeah, I'll have links for his stuff out there too, so people can check out. So
awesome,
nice. Oh, well, talking about books, how about and you maybe you've already mentioned it, a favorite martial arts book?
Okay, wow. So I would definitely, on the nonfiction side, I would say Beast by Doug Merlino. Just a fantastic book.
Okay.
Sam Sheridan's books, A Fighter's Mind and A Fighter's Heart.
Yes.
I don't think your younger listeners will have heard of these books, but they came out in the late 2000s?
Yeah, I was going to say mid to late 2000s, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Just fantastic books.
Trying to get him on the show, so no luck so far.
Oh, that'd be great. Just wonderful books.
Yeah.
And then the fiction side, anything by Barry Eisler, who is, you know, he's a friend, but Barry's books, and I've been a fan from the get-go. Mm-hmm. His John Rain books, Livia Lone. He's got several series out.
Yeah,
and they're all just they're great.
Yeah, no, I know when he talked about before I started recording how I pitched this idea to a radio station like a little over a decade ago and had like guests lined up and sponsors. Barry was one of the guests I had lined up back then. I had got a hold of his manager at the time and we were ready to go. And I was supposed to interview Barry 13 years ago instead of last year. So, I mean,
last year.
Yeah, exactly. So that's why I'm glad when he agreed to do it for the podcast too. So it would have been interesting if I would have done it then and then compared the two. Would have been cool to listen to the differences and stuff. Yeah. But
although I think you would have found, and I listened to your interview with him, and I think you would have found that, I mean, the guy is just a great conversationalist and full of knowledge about so many different things.
And funny.
And funny as hell. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, and he's been that way for as long as I've known him. We used to have long discussions over lunch after jiu-jitsu practice and many, many dinners after that.
Cool.
Here in Japan. So yeah, always really fascinating.
Yeah.
And fun.
He's a good guy. All right. This one you may not have an answer for. Do you have a favorite martial arts video game? Did you ever get into games at all?
Oh, God, no. I'm not a video game guy.
Okay. No worries. That's
I'd have to check with, I'd have to check with my sons. Okay. They might
know. That's fine. That's fine. How about a favorite martial arts TV show?
Oh, Kung Fu. Come on.
All right. And now, so I've had out of my last 10 interviews, I've had, I think, 4 guests pick that one now. And I have to ask you, because they just announced it like a week and a half ago from when we're recording this. Did you hear that they're doing a new movie version of Kung Fu starring Donnie Yen?
No. But yeah. That sounds great.
I know. That was my reaction too. I can't wait.
Well, but, I'm going to have to look that up.
Yeah. I was not a fan of the reboot TV series that just came out like 2 years ago. Wasn't a huge fan of that one, but the fact that they're actually going old school and doing Donnie Yen, and I'm excited. Very excited.
That's cool. You know, I'm sure you know that Bruce Lee was originally to play, right?
Yep.
And
so speaking of that, have you watched the show Warrior?
You know, I've watched the first few episodes and I have yet to watch the rest of it, but great show.
Because you know that's based on Bruce's notes for Kung Fu.
I'd read that somewhere. Yes.
Yeah. His daughter Shannon's like the executive producer of it. And it just dropped on Netflix yesterday, the first 3 seasons. No, so they're
awesome.
If it goes well, they're hoping that Netflix will do a 4th season. Fingers crossed. Great. I'm going to binge it just so it'll get some extra looks.
That's great. Yeah. I'm going to be sure to binge it myself.
All right. How about a favorite martial arts movie?
Favorite martial arts movie would have to be Enter the Dragon.
Nice.
Yeah. So I was 1973. No, it wasn't 73. It came out in 73.
Yep.
It was 75 or 76, and I was at a tournament in Lake Tahoe with my dojo mates. Mm-hmm. And after the tournament, we all went and saw Enter the Dragon at a local theater there in Tahoe. And we came out of that theater, and everybody was just so pumped up. Just, and then I probably seen, you know, like most of your listeners and you, I've seen Enter the Dragon, at least 100 times, right?
Yeah.
Recite probably the whole movie.
Well, and me, I'm a few years younger than you. The first time I actually saw it in the movie theater was about 6 months ago when they re-released it for the 50th anniversary. It played in my local theater. I mean, I had seen it on video easily 50 to 100 times, but first time I saw it on the theater was in 2023.
So how was it on the big screen?
Oh, just so freaking awesome. And my 20-year-old son wanted to come with too, which was kind of cool. So,
that is cool.
Yeah, it was. And it sucks that they didn't promote it. Like, I called the movie theater, like, hey, I'll help you fill this place. Can you give me some posters? I'll bring it to every martial arts school in town. And we don't use outside people for promotion. I'm like, I'm not trying to charge you. You give me posters and I will like freely give them to every martial arts school in town. I'll drive there on my own dime to get people to pack this theater. And they had no interest. Like, wow.
We didn't buy it.
Yeah. And only like 20 people showed up in the theater. And I was so sad. It wasn't promoted at all. There was nothing. I told the local newspaper, I'm like, hey, you should mention that this is coming back, and nothing. So it was kind of sad. It was very, very sad.
Yeah. What a shame.
Yeah, I know. But you try to help people and they just don't want it. So
you lead a horse to water.
That's right. All right. This question now doesn't have to be a martial arts movie. Any movie you've ever seen, favorite movie fight scene?
Favorite movie fight scene. Oh, God. You know, so the scene that jumps out in my mind is that scene in Haywire with Gina Carano, mm-hmm. right? It is Gina Carano, right?
Yep. Yep, yeah, she was in Haywire.
And I forget who the who was the male lead in that movie, but they're in a cafe.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it wasn't the male lead. She gets in a fight in this cafe with this guy, and I don't remember the details of the fight. But that one, I mean, it's a scene that grabs you by the throat.
Yeah,
it's super realistic looking and intense and violent.
Nice.
So that one.
I'll have to rewatch that. I probably haven't watched that movie since it came out, and that was like over a decade ago. So I should probably rewatch
it. Yeah, I'll have to rewatch it too. But that, and so it's kind of, it's pretty amazing. That's the one that popped into my
mind. I forgot. I mean, God, Ewan McGregor's in that. Channing Tatum's in that.
Wow. Yeah. Great movie.
Yeah, that's kind of cool. Nice. Cool. Well, Thomas, before I let you go, anything that I forgot to ask you about or that you want to make sure we get out there and include in the episode?
Well, I would just say if you are at all interested in reading a good martial arts action-filled thriller set in Tokyo, I'm pleased to check out my book, Ways to Die in Tokyo. And I know, Brian, you said you would include the link.
Yes, absolutely. And quick question. So is that available? Is that like hardcover, paperback, ebook? Is it all formats?
It's It's available in paperback and ebook.
Okay.
You can buy the paperback on Amazon, or you can buy it. You can go to my website, thomasrangarver.com, mm-hmm. click on the link to Book Baby.
Okay.
And go to the Book Baby store and buy it there. If you can't find it, if they're out of stock on Amazon, okay. I would recommend going to Book Baby and buying it there, because you can always get a copy there.
Okay, perfect. Yeah. Yep, I see it on here right now. Awesome. I will have to order that. That's cool. Cool. Well, seriously, man, this has been a lot of fun. I mean, I'm glad we made it work out, and I'm glad we were able to do this. And I love hearing about you, and I love talking to authors. I really do. My daughter wants to be a writer, so she'll actually listen to the episodes when I interview authors. She thinks that's kind of cool. So, yeah. Awesome. I've been lucky enough. I've interviewed quite a few authors. You know, like I've told many people, like, and you kind of mentioned about, you know, doing it and stuff and just taking time and setting aside. But in this day and age, I think it's so much easier to write a book than it was 20, 30 years ago. You know, so many more tools, so many more options just for publishing and stuff. And
yes.
Yeah. So that's good.
We could go down another rabbit hole just talking about the tools that are available now.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just incredible. I mean, I use, not to go down another rabbit hole, but I use an application called Scrivener to
heard of it. Yep.
Oh, it's just, it's wonderful. It's wonderful. And to think of, you know, like when I first met Barry Eisler, they didn't have Scrivener. I'm pretty sure he used Microsoft Word.
Yep.
And just the thought of trying to write a book just using Word, it just, yeah, it boggles my mind now. So so much to do if you're inclined to write. There's so much knowledge out there about writing both fiction and nonfiction.
Mm-hmm. That's a question I just thought of. And this is one I wish I would have asked Barry. I should just email him just to get his opinion. But as a writer, what are your thoughts on AI type tools for writers? I mean, because now you can literally write a whole chapter, put it in like ChatGPT and say, rewrite this to make it sound like a professional book or something. And it'll rewrite it for you. I mean, what are your thoughts on stuff like that? And I mean, do you think that's good? Do you think that's bad for the industry?
You know, I don't. So as a fiction writer, I struggle to understand how we will get to the point where someone will be able to produce a novel that people will read, a novel that resonates with them on an emotional level. I struggle to understand how AI will be able to do that. And perhaps it will at some point be able to do that. But because I don't think it's there yet, and it might be a long time before it gets there, it doesn't bother me that much.
Okay.
And I also think that people are still going to want to read books that are produced by humans.
I would hope so. I would really hope so.
Yeah. Kind of like, you know, you can maybe analogize it to music, right? When remember when electronic music became all the rage, and there were people who were saying, what's going to happen to live bands, like live performances? Like, aren't people, you know, that people are going to just listen to this electronic stuff, and nobody's going to listen to or want to listen to live music anymore?
Yeah.
And that didn't turn out to be true. So
that is true.
Yeah. Now, on the other hand, ChatGPT and now this new video version, this new video AI that they just read about the other day, they're amazing, amazing tools. And I think for a writer, I think it can be very useful, really. I mean, if you're, you know, especially in terms of idea generation,
that makes sense.
Prompt it. Yeah, you can prompt it. You know, if you're hung up on a character's motivations or something about a certain scene, you can create a prompt that, you know, to give you suggestions about how you can improve the scene.
Okay.
Or what some possible motivations of your character might be given this scenario in this particular scene.
Yeah.
And I think if used in that way, it can be really, you know, really helpful. I tend not to think that it's going to replace writers.
I just think people who are interested in need to rewatch Terminator, because, you know, James Cameron warned us. I'm just saying. they're taking over the world, man.
And they may very well take over the world, but I don't think they're there yet.
As long as it's not in my lifetime, I'm good with it. That's right. Well, Thomas, seriously, this has been a blast. This has been so much fun chatting. I loved hearing your story. Loved hearing about your background. And you know, hopefully we can stay in touch. I can't wait till the episode comes out. And just so you know, it looks like your episode I'm a little ahead right now, which is awesome. Yeah, your episode should be out April 18th. So I'm about 2 months ahead.
fantastic.
It's exciting. But seriously, from the bottom of my heart, thank you for taking the time. And I can't wait till people hear this.
Well, thanks back at you. It's been a real pleasure and an honor, really. I enjoy listening to your podcast and will continue to do so. And yeah, I hope we can stay in touch. This has been awesome.
Thanks for listening to Everyday Martial Artist. We hope you will join us every week for a brand new episode with a different martial artist telling their story. If you enjoy the show, be sure to leave us a review. Also, be sure to check out our website at everydaymartialartist.com. There you can find all of our episodes and contact us to suggest guests and ask questions. Again, thanks for listening to Everyday Martial Artist, and we'll see you next week.